Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 223. It's Monday, August 7th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, well, first up, let's start with the single largest preventable cause of death on the planet, which is tobacco. This from the World Health Organization. 7 out of 10 people worldwide are protected by at least one best practice tobacco control measure. A new World Health Organization report highlights that 5.6 billion people, 71% of the world's population, are now protected with at least one best practice policy to help save lives from deadly tobacco. This is 5 times more than in 2007. In the last 15 years, since World Health Organization's Empower tobacco control measures were introduced globally, smoking rates have fallen. Without this decline, there would have been an estimated 300 million more smokers in the world today. The WHO report on the global tobacco epidemic is focused on protecting the public from secondhand smoke, highlighting that almost 40% of countries now have completely smoke-free indoor places. Smoke-free public places is just one policy in the set of effective tobacco control measures. Empower to help countries implement the WHO Framework Convention on Tobacco Control and curb the tobacco epidemic. Smoke-free environments help people breathe clean air, shield the public from deadly secondhand smoke, motivate people to quit, denormalize smoking, and help prevent young people from ever starting to smoke or use e-cigarettes. While smoking rates have been going down, tobacco is still the leading cause of preventable death in the world, largely due to relentless marketing campaigns by the tobacco industry. There is still much more work to be done. 44 countries remain unprotected by any of the WHO's Empower measures, and 53 countries still do not have complete smoking bans in healthcare facilities. Meanwhile, only about half of countries have smoke-free private workplaces and restaurants. WHO urges all countries to put in place all of the Empower measures at best practice level to fight the tobacco epidemic, which kills 8.7 million people globally each year, and to push back against the tobacco and nicotine industries who lobby against these public health measures, said Dr. Rutger Kreck, the WHO Director of Health Promotion. Around 1.3 million people die from secondhand smoke every year. All of these deaths are entirely preventable. People exposed to secondhand tobacco smoke are at risk of dying from heart disease, stroke, respiratory diseases, type 2 diabetes, and cancers. This report demonstrates that all countries, irrespective of income levels, can drive down the demand for tobacco, achieve major wins for public health, and save economies billions of dollars in health care and productivity losses. Go anti-tobacco efforts. And for you Ohioans who are smokers who may want to quit or know somebody who might be interested in quitting, you can call the Ohio Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW. That's 1-800-QUIT-NOW for help in quitting tobacco. Okay, let's switch gears and do a few stories on violence. First up, from Michigan Public Radio, poll shows a majority of Americans support universal background checks, gun licensing, and an assault weapons ban. The McCourtney Institute for Democracy's latest Mood of the Nation poll, conducted in May, finds that 86% of American adults support U.S. Congress mandating background checks for all firearm sales and transfers. Nearly three-quarters support Congress requiring gun owners to take a test, obtain a license, and register their firearms, similar to the process of owning an automobile. A bipartisan majority of Americans support two of those policies, universal background checks and gun licensing. An assault weapons ban also received majority support, but support and opposition were far more partisan. Nearly half of Americans support eliminating current gun laws and protecting the Second Amendment, also split along party lines. Second Amendment supporters' views on gun policies? It is noteworthy that the three firearm-restricting provisions included in this poll are supported by a majority of those who support eliminating, quote, most current gun laws in order to protect Second Amendment rights. Among those Second Amendment advocates, 77% support universal background checks, 60% support a testing, licensing, and registering process for guns similar to that of automobiles, and 52% support an assault weapons ban. The firearm-related questions included in this poll were replicated from a 2019 poll, factoring in the margin of error associated with each. Overall support for the three gun-restricting measures is unchanged. There is, however, statistically significant 10 percentage point increase in overall support for eliminating most current gun laws in order to protect Second Amendment rights. So it's interesting that the policies that people support actually hasn't changed in recent years, but that you have a pretty decent jump in those that want to eliminate most current gun laws in order to protect the Second Amendment rights. I think this just shows that we have an increasing partisanship as far as gun violence prevention goes. But good news that there's overwhelming support for three major gun violence prevention initiatives. And perhaps another example of a huge gap between the will of the people and democracy actually present in our government. Okay, well, next up, want to do a story that reminds us that when we talk about gun violence, most of those deaths are actually self-inflicted suicides. This from WUSF in Florida. Miami's top cop shot himself. Mental health remains an issue for first responders. Last year, 64 police officers were fatally shot in the line of duty nationwide. There were 160 who took their own lives. The biggest threat to law enforcement officers, and often their families, is not any armed criminal. It is themselves. Miami-Dade Police Director Freddy Ramirez stands as a tragic example of where mental health and policing intersect. He remains at Tampa General Hospital after shooting himself in the head last Sunday night with his service revolver. Before he shot himself, he had his hands around his wife's throat, media reports say. This incident is also a tragic reminder of the critical role that mental health plays in our law enforcement officers' well-being, said the Miami-Dade mayor. The reality is that these jobs are very demanding. They're stressful and they're emotionally taxing. They often require officers to put their lives on the line. Law enforcement officers have a 54% increase in suicide risk compared to the general public. Before COVID, suicide was the number one cause of death in law enforcement, said Stedman Stahl, president of South Florida Police Benevolent Association. So it is interesting to note that COVID was actually more deadly than lethal violence for police officers during the years of the pandemic. First responders across the board are at risk. Police officers, firefighters, EMTs, 911 operators all must deal with tragedy on a routine basis. Shootings, horrific car accidents, drownings, drug overdoses, and child abuse. Okay, well, next up I have a story that dovetails with this one as well, in that it gets at violence in various occupations. And while law enforcement is seen as a very violent occupation, actually healthcare is a very violent occupation. People that work in healthcare are definitely at more risk for violence. In fact, even more assaults than law enforcement. This from the Associated Press. Attacks at U.S. hospitals show why healthcare is one of the nation's most violent fields. Word spread through an Oregon hospital last month that a visitor was causing trouble in the maternity ward, and nurses were warned that a man might try to abduct his partner's newborn. Hours later, the visitor opened fire, killing a security guard and sending patients, nurses, and doctors scrambling for cover. The shooting at Legacy Good Samaritan Medical Center in Portland was part of a wave of gun violence sweeping through U.S. hospitals and medical centers, which have struggled to adapt to the growing threats. Such attacks have helped make healthcare one of the nation's most violent fields. Data shows American healthcare workers now suffer more non-fatal injuries from workplace violence than workers in any other profession, including law enforcement. Healthcare workers don't even think about that when they decide they want to be a nurse or a doctor. But as far as actual violence goes, statistically, healthcare is 4 to 5 times more dangerous than any other profession, said Michael DeAngelo, a former police officer who focuses on healthcare and workplace violence as a security consultant in Florida. Other industries outpace healthcare for overall danger, including deaths. It's not just deadly shootings. Healthcare workers racked up 73% of all non-fatal workplace violence injuries in 2018, the most recent year for which figures are available, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. Around 40 states have passed laws creating or increasing penalties for violence against healthcare workers, according to the American Nurses Association. Hospitals have armed security officers with batons, stun guns, or handguns, while some states, including Indiana, Ohio, and Georgia, allow hospitals to create their own police forces. Critics say private hospital police can exacerbate the healthcare and policing inequities already experienced by Black people. They also say private police forces often don't have to disclose information, such as how often they use force or whether they disproportionately detain members of minority groups. Security teams cannot address all the factors leading to violence because many of them are caused by a dysfunctional healthcare system, said Deborah Berger, a registered nurse and president of the National Nurses United. Patients and families are often bounced between emergency rooms and home and are frustrated over high costs, limited treatment options, or long wait times. Hospitals don't really have a complaints department, so the only real target they have is the nurse or staff that are standing right in front of them, she said. Understaffing forces nurses to care for more patients and affords them less time to assess each one for behavior problems. Efforts to de-escalate aggression aren't as effective if nurses haven't had time to bond with patients, Berger said. Growing nurse-to-patient ratios are an absolutely catastrophic formula for workplace violence increasing, DeAngelo said. Now you don't even have the good old buddy system of two co-workers keeping an eye out for each other. Some hospital administrators encourage staff to placate aggressive visitors and patients because they are worried about getting bad reviews, Berger said. That's because the Affordable Care Act tied a portion of federal reimbursement rates to consumer satisfaction surveys, and low satisfaction means a hit to the financial bottom line. The results of those surveys should never take priority over staff safety, DeAngelo said. Eric Sean Clay, the president-elect of the International Association for Healthcare Security and Safety, and vice president of security at Memorial Hermann Health in Houston, said the workplace violence rates attributed to healthcare facilities are, quote, grossly underreported. I think that a lot of it comes down to caregivers are just very tolerant, and they come to look at it as just part of the job, he said. If they're not injured, sometimes they don't want to report it, and sometimes they don't think there's going to be any change. Clay Hospital uses armed and unarmed security officers, though he hopes to have them all armed eventually. We actually have our own firing range that we use, Clay said. None of his security officers have drawn their weapons on the job in recent years, but he wants them to be ready because of the rise in gun violence. Clay and Memorial Hermann Health declined to answer questions about whether an armed security force could negatively affect access to healthcare or existing inequities. You know, you always say that patients and their families are so vulnerable because they're having the worst day of their life here, the nurse said, and that makes many staffers reluctant to demand better behavior. We have to stop that narrative. Being vulnerable is bleeding out from a bullet wound in your chest. Being vulnerable is having to barricade yourself and your patients in a room because of code silver, which indicates a weapon is present. Yikes. Scary. Particularly scary since healthcare is supposed to be a place of healing and often results in violence. Okay, next up, have another healthcare-related story, and this gets at the issues of abortion being criminalized. And where abortion isn't outright banned, there's a lot of stifling of healthcare, partly because it isn't clear, and having criminal serious penalties, healthcare providers and hospitals are very reluctant to act in many cases when they normally would and by ethical obligation would be required to act. This from Stat News. Doctors in states that ban abortion can still refer patients elsewhere. Why are so few doing that? For now, abortion remains accessible even in states where it's banned, at least for those who know where to look. It's still legal in two-thirds of the country, and numerous websites explain how to order medications from international pharmacies to end early pregnancies at home. But not all patients have equal access to reliable information. Even before Roe v. Wade's reversal, the most vulnerable U.S. patients, particularly low-income women, women of color, and first-generation immigrants, disproportionately lacked accurate knowledge about abortion access. Today, almost half of Americans are uncertain about the legality of medication abortion. And I must note, like as I've reported before, these very same populations actually are not a small part of women seeking abortions. This is the overwhelming majority. That's why we should be alarmed by a recent report by the Kaiser Family Foundation, which found that in states that make it a crime for a doctor to provide an abortion, 78% of OB-GYNs don't make an out-of-state referral, and 30% don't inform their patients about online resources explaining their abortion options. In states that ban providing abortion between 6 and 22 weeks, 44% of OB-GYNs don't refer for abortion services, and 10% don't offer information. These numbers mark a dramatic departure from all-options pregnancy counseling, which has been the governing standard of care for decades. Clinicians are duty-bound to provide abortion information because it is legal in most states. Patients have a constitutional right to travel, and abortion care remains essential for preventing maternal morbidity and mortality. Globally, unsafe abortions cause 39,000 deaths a year, along with millions of hospitalizations. Without access to accurate abortion information, U.S. patients have begun adding to these numbers. Widespread availability of abortion medications has made illegal abortion less dangerous than in the past, but not all patients possess the health literacy required to navigate their options. Vulnerable populations such as poor people of color are disproportionately likely to struggle to identify accurate health information. Crucially, these patients come from the same segment of the population that is more likely to experience an unwanted pregnancy. They are also more likely to seek abortions. Prior to Dobbs, 75% of abortion patients were people living below or just above the poverty line. This context creates an ethical imperative for clinicians to provide abortion information. Doctors' silence violates their central ethical obligations to respect patients' autonomy, advance justice, and promote beneficence. Patient autonomy is the linchpin of modern medical ethics, and withholding information strips patients of it because it denies or delays their ability to make an informed decision consistent with their values. It is unjust for doctors to leave those with lower health literacy unable to exercise the options available to more educated patients. This withholding also escalates medical and legal risks for the most vulnerable patients, who may use later, riskier methods, fall prey to anti-abortion misinformation, experience poor outcomes, and when things go wrong, bear the risk of prosecution, which disproportionately targets poor Black and brown women. The Kaiser Family Foundation survey shows OB-GYNs already understand the racist impact of abortion bans. 70% of OB-GYNs report a worsening of racial and ethnic inequities in maternal health since the Dobbs decision. Bound by the duty of beneficence, the requirement of doing good for patients, doctors must lessen these risks by sharing accurate abortion information. The astonishing thing about clinicians' rapid shift away from an all-options counseling is that to date, no state has prosecuted a doctor for sharing abortion information. In fact, no state law includes a blanket ban on the sharing of abortion information. Instead, the chilling effect of these bans has led doctors to pull back from ethical medical practice. They fear sharing even basic information, the fact that abortion is legal elsewhere, or the names of trustworthy websites, which could trigger negative legal and professional consequences. Their concern is understandable because the question of whether sharing abortion information creates real risk is largely untested. But this legal uncertainty works to the advantage of abortion opponents. Uncertainty silences clinicians and traps patients without requiring unpopular prosecutions or controversial laws implicating the First Amendment or the constitutional right to travel. Witness the rapid about-face of Idaho's Attorney General Raul Labrador, who in March 2023 issued an advisory opinion asserting that Ohio law, quote, prohibits an Idaho medical provider from referring a woman across state lines to access abortion services. on the grounds that referrals amount to assisting abortion, and asserting that Ohio law, quote, requires a suspension of healthcare professionals' license for doing so. He quickly withdrew this guidance after being sued for constitutional violations by the ACLU and local physicians. Still, one might understand if Idaho clinicians feel reluctant to test this position by sharing abortion information. Practicing in a legal climate that threatens prison sentences for standard medical care takes a horrible toll on clinicians, and the chilling effect that converts bans on providing abortions into silence on anything related to abortion is predictable. Indeed, sometimes it is driven by hospital lawyers whose guidance may emphasize reducing risk to institutions rather than reducing risk to patients. However, refusing to provide abortion information in order to minimize legal risk violates a strong professional norm against permitting outside concerns to undermine sound medical practice. The American Medical Association's Code of Ethics preamble instructs that, quote, in exceptional circumstances of unjust laws, ethical responsibility should supersede legal duties. When doctors prioritize their own interests in avoiding potential legal risks above the health of their patients, they negate their core ethical and professional obligations to their patients. They also saddle vulnerable patients with risks that are more serious and more likely to ensue. No clinician should face these risks alone. Professional organizations in any clinical practice area in which a healthcare provider might encounter a pregnant patient should adopt guidelines requiring the sharing of abortion information. They should specify, at a minimum, that clinicians share the names of trusted websites where patients can find accurate information about abortion options and counsel their patients on data privacy. This guidance would protect doctors and patients, making it plain that regardless of whether providing an abortion is legal in their state, sound medical and ethical practice requires all options counseling. Further, these organizations should commit to supporting members who suffer repercussions for providing abortion information. A full year after the end of Roe, clinicians practicing under abortion bans are still left largely to chart their own course. Ultimately, the decision to avoid sharing information implicates the medical profession as a whole. In remaining silent, clinicians adopt a standard of care not set by sound practice, but by fear of state lawmakers. Their silence marks their willing conscription into a battle that weaponizes educational, economic, and health disparities, leading the most vulnerable patients to incorrectly conclude they have no option but to continue unwanted pregnancies. So sometimes courage is a prime response to bullies and intimidation. Of course, abortion is now a perfect example of how what was for decades long considered standard medical practice is shredded fragmented across the United States. Just one more reason to try to pull for a more universal health care policy and universal insurance. This next story from Stat News. Enough with the health care policy patchwork. It's time for universal insurance. Everyone knows that the United States is the only high-income country without universal health insurance. According to the standard narrative, this is the inevitable result of U.S. exceptionalism with different values, culture, and institutions. Not so. The impetus for universal coverage is as strong in the United States as in any other country. In fact, the United States enacted the world's very first national compulsory health insurance law in 1798. Nope, that's not a typo, nor is it merely an esoteric piece of historical trivia. The driving force behind the early federal health insurance mandate speaks volumes to the problem that the United States has been trying and failing to solve for centuries, how to provide access to essential health care regardless of resources. The existence of this unwritten social contract may be hard to believe in a country that has yet to enact universal health insurance and a society that advocates for lifting oneself up by the bootstraps, yet the record is clear. Our country has always tried to provide essential medical care to those who are ill and unable to provide for their own care. It's time to finally fulfill this commitment. Once we recognize that we always have and always will attempt to provide access to medical care to those who are ill and cannot provide it for themselves, the only solution is to formalize that commitment upfront with insurance coverage. Alexander Hamilton articulated this argument over two centuries ago. He urged the brand new Congress to create what became a compulsory tax-financed health insurance program for commercial seamen. It bore an eerie resemblance to the 21st century Obamacare, an insurance mandate coupled with a fine for noncompliance. The 18th century version required that whenever a U.S. ship arrived back from a foreign port, each ship owner had to deduct a tax of 20 cents per sailor per month at sea from the sailor's wages and pay it to the customs agent, who then transferred this money to the federal government. Ship owners who were caught avoiding the tax faced a $100 fine. The rationale for the mandate? Seamen hailed from throughout the nation, but when they fell ill, they became a concentrated burden on the local port communities and the charitable hospitals that provided care for patients without family members around to do so. The solution? Make the sailors contribute upfront to a fund that would be collected by the government and used, according to the 1798 Act, quote, to provide for the temporary relief and maintenance of sick or disabled seamen in the hospitals or other proper institutions. As then Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton explained in a 1792 letter to Congress urging the adoption of the policy, the need for it stemmed from, quote, humanity's tendency to protect from want and misery a very needy class of the community. In the 20th and 21st centuries, this very same tendency, the human impulse to intervene when individuals are ill and lack the resources to care for themselves, has been the driving force behind our long history of healthcare policy patches that have tried, but so far failed, to fully fulfill our moral commitments. It was behind the enactment of Medicare and Medicaid in the 60s to provide health insurance to the elderly and the indigent. And it has been behind the many subsequent piecemeal policies that have since expanded coverage for people with particular diseases, including breast cancer, tuberculosis, end-stage kidney failure, HIV/AIDS, Lou Gehrig's disease, sickle cell anemia, and most recently, COVID, or for people in particular circumstances, such as pregnant women, prisoners, or disabled individuals. In enacting the 1972 policy patch that expanded Medicare to provide coverage to long-term disabled people, President Nixon declared that the policy, quote, reaffirms and reinforces America's traditional efforts to assist those of our citizens who, through no fault of their own, are unable to help themselves. Even a casual knowledge of the current state of U.S. health policy makes clear that these traditional efforts have not been fully successful. About 1 in 10 Americans under 65 remains uninsured. Those who are fortunate enough to have insurance live with the constant danger of losing it if they become unemployed, give birth, get older, get healthier, get richer, or move. Even if they manage to maintain their insurance, they still face the risk of enormous medical bills for their, quote, covered care. But these problems represent the failure to fulfill the obligations we acknowledge, not their absence. There's only one way to fulfill our innate and inevitable societal instinct to come to the aid of individuals who are ill and lack the resources to care for themselves: automatic, basic, universal coverage. This instinct and this solution have been acknowledged across the world. In the mid-20th century, the famous free market Austrian economist F.A. Hayek railed against the newly formed British Nail Health Service while simultaneously embracing the Hamiltonian rationale for compulsory health insurance. The Swiss likewise invoked what they described as, quote, the recognized duty of the public to provide for the extreme needs of sickness when they created mandatory universal coverage in 1996. In the past few decades, this rationale for universal coverage has also been embraced by American leaders from across the political spectrum. Massachusetts Republican Governor Mitt Romney mandated universal coverage in Massachusetts several years before the 2010 Affordable Care Act. He argued that individuals who fall ill but lack health insurance will ultimately receive medical care but not pay for most of it, so we should mandate that they, like the 18th century mariners, purchase insurance to fund that care up front. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg likewise invoked the, quote, embedded social norms to provide care when it is needed most, regardless of the patient's ability to pay, in her 2012 opinion supporting the constitutionality of the Obama administration's health insurance mandate. The instinct was right, but the implementation was off. As we now all know, although the U.S. mandated universal coverage in 2010, it has not achieved it. 30 million Americans remain uninsured. Calling it universal does not make it so. The only solution to provide coverage automatically, financed out of the taxes on earned income. Just as it was for seamen in the 18th century, it can be quite basic, Our social norm is about providing essential care, not luxury service, but until we do so, our drive to fulfill our social obligations will doom us to repeat the endless cycle of imperfect half measures and inadequate healthcare policy patches that has been our healthcare history for more than half a century. This is neither a liberal nor a conservative argument. It is merely good sense. And that brings us to this.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has health care. The infestation of health care for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure health care for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
And you'll only hear PSAs like that on Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, next up, have a story about cancer and how have much underutilized genetic testing that could get at about the 10% of cancer that comes from genetic mutations. This from NPR. Cancer risk can lurk in our genes. Testing is cheap. Why do few people get it? Cancer is the second leading cause of death in the United States, and about 10% of cancer is thought to come from inherited genetic mutations that increase risk. Experts say that millions of people in the U.S. are walking around with a genetic variant that raises the risk of developing cancer. The vast majority of them have no clue. A simple, relatively inexpensive blood test can now check dozens of genes associated with different kinds of cancer. Cancer of the breast, ovaries, colon, pancreas, stomach, prostate, and more. A decade ago, genetic screening for inherited cancer risk cost thousands of dollars. As a result, physicians were more selective about who got referred for this testing. In recent years, though, that cost has come down dramatically. It's a much more reasonable price, said Tara Biaggi, a genetic counselor with MedStar Georgetown University Hospital. She explains that these days, the out-of-pocket cost for someone without insurance could be around $250. Rather than the $4,000, which is what used to be, people with insurance might pay nothing or just a copay. Testing is also more informative, as labs can now check a slew of cancer-linked genes at once. Health insurance providers have loosened their restrictions on whom they will cover for this kind of testing, which means more people than ever have access. Nonetheless, most people that should be getting tested are not, says Dr. Tuya Pal, a clinical geneticist at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. Researchers estimate that about 5% of people living in the U.S. have one of the known genetic mutations that can significantly increase cancer risk, says Allison Kurian, a cancer physician at Stanford University. Kurian and some colleagues recently did a study looking at over a million people diagnosed with cancer in Georgia and California. Only 6.8% of them ever got tested for inheritable genetic variants linked to cancer. One recent study looked at how many cases of hereditary cancer syndromes would be found if doctors did genetic testing in just every patient with cancer. Researchers performed the testing on nearly 3,000 patients with all kinds of solid tumors, regardless of their age or family history. Nearly 1 in 8 patients had a cancer predisposition Gene, said Dr. Jewel Samadar of the Mayo Clinic in Phoenix. In addition to alerting family members that they could be at risk, he says knowing that information frequently helped people choose the best treatment for their own cancer. Asked why so few people get tested, both researchers and patients said that many cancer doctors aren't familiar with the latest research on inherited risk, or that they don't know the cost of testing has dropped. Another problem is that patients or their relatives don't know to ask their doctors for this testing. So one additional thing you can do, although I might add, you know, this is true for a lot of genetic risk, whether it's heart disease or cancer. Generally, the preventive things that you would do to avoid cancer in the first place are reduced by a similar proportion, whether you're at lower risk or higher risk, say, because of a genetic predisposition. So hopefully cancer being the second leading cause of death would be enough to motivate people. But if you're thinking you may need more motivation, you may want to get screened for genetic predisposition to cancer. Okay, well, next up, we're going to stick to the theme of cancer, but this story is very interesting because it really connects two different public health crises that seem unrelated. This from Stat News. Without a plan to fight superbugs, the cancer moonshot will never achieve liftoff. Researchers at the National Institute of Health recently outlined strategies to tackle President Biden's Cancer Moonshot Initiative, which aims to cut cancer deaths in half over the next 25 years. They made one glaring omission, a plan to combat drug-resistant superbugs. Two public health crises, cancer and drug-resistant infections, are deeply intertwined. Patients with cancer are three times more likely to die of an infection than patients without the disease. Unless we quickly mobilize to fight superbugs, the cancer moonshot will never achieve liftoff. The toll of superbugs is already steep. More than 3 million Americans develop a drug-resistant infection each year, and nearly 50,000 of them die from it. And it's getting worse. Drug-resistant infections pose a particular threat to cancer patients, whose immune systems are weakened from fighting the disease and undergoing harsh treatments like chemotherapy and radiation. The crisis is so severe that infection is now the second leading cause of death for cancer patients, according to research published in the Cancer Journal CA. The same study noted that well over a quarter of the pathogens behind post-chemotherapy infections in cancer patients had evolved to resist the very antibiotics used to treat them. We'll need to develop more new antibiotics to fight off this growing threat and accomplish the goals of the cancer moonshot, but that's easier said than done. The number of pharmaceutical companies pursuing antibiotic research has declined from 18 in 1990 to a mere 5 in 2020. And the number of new antibiotics approved for the market has dropped from 3 per year in the 1980s to fewer than 1 per year since 2000. There's a simple reason. Antibiotics are a bad investment. Another note about why free market healthcare system isn't all that great. Discovering and marketing a new drug is a high-risk proposition in even the best-case scenario, when a company might recoup the millions of dollars they'd invested if they managed to back a winner. But that's only true if the drug will be prescribed often and used for a long time. Antibiotics, on the other hand, are a last resort that doctors use sparingly and for as short a time as possible. If a drug company is looking to make a decent return on their investment or risk going out of business, they're not going to pick antibiotics. If we want to cut cancer deaths, we can't give up, and we don't have to. A bipartisan group of lawmakers in Congress recently reintroduced the Pasteur Act, a bill that can give us the upper hand we so desperately need against antibiotic-resistant infections. Under the legislation, companies that invest in a new FDA-approved antibiotic wouldn't have to worry about recouping the funds on the drug market. Instead, they could get payments directly from the federal government. They'd be inoculated against the market forces that have put us at a disadvantage for so long, enabling us to fight and win the twin epidemics of antimicrobial resistance and cancer. And of course, I've reported in earlier shows that antibiotic resistance generally in a population could become like the leading cause of death by 2050. This is really one of those pivotal moments. Of course, we can leverage it, hopefully, by our understanding of its grand effects on cancer and the threat that it has for cancer patients. But this is a problem for everybody. You don't have to be driving cancer deaths, the second leading cause in the death in the U.S., in order to support fighting antimicrobial resistance superbugs. Okay, well, last up in my regular reporting, I just wanted to do a follow-up on that new Alzheimer's drug. This from Kaiser Family Foundation Health News. The real cost of the new Alzheimer's drug, most of which will fall to taxpayers. The first drug purporting to slow the advance of Alzheimer's disease is likely to cost the U.S. healthcare system billions annually, even as it remains out of reach for many of the lower-income seniors most likely to suffer from dementia. Medicare and Medicaid patients will make up 92% of the market for the drug under the brand name Leqembi. In addition to the company's $26,500 annual price tag for the drug, treatment could cost U.S. taxpayers $82,500 per patient per year on average for genetic tests and frequent brain scans, safety monitoring, and other care, according to estimates from the Institute for Clinical and Economic Review, ICER. The FDA gave the drug full approval July 6th. About 1 million Alzheimer's patients in the U.S. could qualify to use it. In anticipation of additional costs from the Leqembi drug class, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services in 2021 increased monthly premiums for Medicare patients by 15%, and premiums may rise again in 2024 after a slight decline this year. Such increases can be a significant burden for many of the 62 million Medicare subscribers who live on fixed incomes. Real people will be affected. A study that estimated Leqembi's and related care would cost Medicare $2 to $5 billion a year, making it one of the most expensive taxpayer-funded treatments. In its analysis, ICER suggested that Leqembi could be cost-effective at an annual price of $8,900 to $21,500. In an interview, David Rind, ICER's chief medical officer, said $10,000 to $15,000 a year would be more reasonable. Above that range doesn't seem like a good place, he said. Whatever its price, patients may be delayed getting access to Leqembi because of the relative shortage of specialists capable of managing the drug, which will require genetic and neuropsychological testing, as well as PET scans to confirm a patient's eligibility. Again, I would ask the question, if you had $80,000 per year to spend on somebody with mild cognitive impairment to improve their life and perhaps reduce the development of more cognitive impairment, I'm guessing we'd find a lot of options that would probably spend a lot less for more results and perhaps be less medicalizing and more humane. Okay, well, let's get to our last regular segment, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment. Available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. And because last week was a greatest hit show, we had 2 weeks of collecting bonus articles, so we have a record 39 articles. Let's get to it. Number one, study shows 8 out of 10 child deaths in low-income countries could be prevented. Yes, we're going for the most improved award. We have a long way to go. And back in this country, bonus article number 2, legislators rolling back child labor protections. This is actually happening while child labor violations are rising quickly. Bonus article 3, the world is not prepared for another cholera wave. So we've had dozens of outbreaks of cholera, and the WHO has a mechanism and some resources to try to deal with this, but it's been overwhelming. So we need to up our game. And on the worldwide infectious disease front, bonus article 4, ProMed, an early warning system on disease outbreaks, appears near collapse. So this is a really kind of one of those bizarre things that, you know, probably for a few million dollars, maybe less, they could actually keep this early warning system on disease outbreaks, which has identified each of the last serious disease outbreaks in recent years. But because they can't get enough funding, they're trying this subscription to do this kind of for providers who are mostly doing this for free or very, very inexpensively for a kind of crowdsourcing the collection of potential disease outbreaks. So researchers and people who are doing surveillance can be on it as soon as possible. And the fact that we don't actually have a regular funding source for this is just probably as good example of any how public health is not paid attention to very well and ultimately not very well valued. Boy, you get a lot of bang for buck for that money. Let's make it happen. Bonus Article 5. 17% of U.S. toddlers are falling short on childhood vaccinations. That is, 10% actually do not even start one or more childhood vaccination series, and 17% total, that would be another 7 on top of that 10%, may start a series but not complete it. So, and actually the most infectious one, measles, has dropped under the 95% vaccination rate that you need to prevent outbreaks. So, and that's the second year in a row that we've fallen under that. Bonus Article 6, also a measles story. Measles was once seen as a childhood disease. Increasingly, adults are susceptible to a lot of reasons, but 40% of the people that have been infected with measles in this country over the last 20 years are, in fact, adults. Bonus Article 7, moving to some environmental stories. EPA approved a fuel ingredient, even though it could cause cancer, in virtually every person exposed over a lifetime. So when they did their analysis, they estimated that 1.15 out of every person would get cancer, which basically means it would kill you more than once. This actually is very similar to a story I've reported on a time or two before, but this is actually a new chemical that's being approved by the EPA. Just scary, and doesn't seem to be any reason why. In fact, the EPA has been giving conflicting reasons, and if in fact they made a mistake in how they talked about something, it would be the first time. So either way, there's some incompetence going on there. Need to fix that up. Another thing hanging out there, bonus Article 8, the Halliburton loophole allows fracking companies to avoid chemical regulation. Now, we've known this to be true for a long time, but because there's no transparency when a chemical company doing fracking says, it's a proprietary mix, so we don't need to say what it is. There was actually one database of some of these companies, fracking companies, and it showed that, wow, there's like 28 different chemicals that would normally be regulated but avoid regulation because of this loophole. Bonus Article 9, not surprisingly, outdoor air pollution may increase non-lung cancer risk in older adults. Of course, air pollution with a whole bevy of different chemicals, not surprising it would raise cancer risks in other places than the lung, since particularly the smaller chemicals go straight into your bloodstream. This one is in older adults, but that's because it's easier to study older adults because they get cancer more often, so you don't have to study them quite as long to find out what's going on. Bonus Article 10, black women weigh emerging risks of hair straighteners. I reported on the fact that we're learning that hair straighteners can actually cause cancer quite substantially. They're pretty significant carcinogens, but black women have to contend with the fact that they live in a white beauty culture, and that there's discrimination against black folks with natural hair. The fact that we don't appreciate black beauty actually is driving this health risk. Bonus Article 11, doctors sound alarm about child nicotine poisoning as vapes flood the U.S. market. So vape cartridges actually have to have packaging that is childproof, but the actual cartridge doesn't need to have this. And they're seeing more and more kids getting into this, particularly when you have flavors that kids actually like, because nicotine normally is kind of a bitter thing and a kid would spit it out. But ones that are flavored, kids actually do. It's almost like smoking cigarettes. It's almost impossible to get acute nicotine poisoning. About the only way you can do it is through these cartridges. So just another side effect of the vaping epidemic. Bonus Article 12, lawsuit over Texas abortion ban could be a model in other states where doctors and hospitals are afraid to end dangerous pregnancies. So this was a win that'll maybe cut out some of the lack of clarity and the truncating of regular care that has been done for decades, like reported earlier in the show. Bonus Article 13, doctors emerge as political force in battle over abortion laws in Ohio and elsewhere. Ohio's among at least five states where physicians have mobilized to protect reproductive rights. So this week we have issue one. Hopefully it'll go down substantially. But doctors have played a particular role in Ohio. Bonus article 14. Drug makers go under the skin with injectables, skirting U.S. Medicare price negotiations. So this is the one where Medicare is going to be able to negotiate prices for drugs finally after years and years and years of battling for that. But drug makers, like tax attorneys, figure out a way to get around it. And because the Medicare pricing doesn't target injectables, they're just turning their drugs into injectables, trying to get in a classification that's outside price negotiations. Yikes. Bonus article 15. Why be that slimy when you can just go right to the business model? Doctors say insurers are ignoring orders to pay surprise billing disputes. So there's been legislation that has tried to regulate these surprise billing issues. And in fact, when a patient or a provider wins that dispute, they're not paid 52% of the time, and of those ones that they win, a third of them that are paid, that third that is paid is not actually the correct amount. They decide, oh, we'll just pay this rather than that. And so you need more regulation enforcement around that. Bonus article 16, millions more Americans have medical debt than student debt. Where's the relief? So this is just kind of highlighting the fact, even though student debt stuff is put off at least for a number of years while it goes through the regulatory process, another way to get student debt, medical debt is crushing people and has been the number one cause of bankruptcy for many, many years, and that continues. Bonus article 17, I'm going to be homeless. Ohio Medicaid collects $87.5 million from families after loved one's death. So if a person on Medicaid dies, the state, and Ohio is the most aggressive in the country, comes after the assets. So the poorest people with the least amount of assets are driven into zeroing out what potential small generational wealth could be passed on to kids. And the I'm going to be homeless is that if you have a child or caretaker that's in that home, they may get thrown out of it. 18. Options and resources available to help avoid Medicare taking your assets. There's a little how-to to try to get around that other story. Bonus article 19, all U.S. racial and ethnic minority groups are underrepresented in Alzheimer's neuroimaging research. So, black folks particularly are at least 50% more likely to get Alzheimer's, yet they're not being represented in the research. Bonus article 20, marijuana addiction is real. Those struggling often face skepticism. Just another example in public health, you know, probably about 1% of people that regularly use marijuana actually have a major addiction. But there's a lot of people using marijuana, so it's a significant issue. And we shouldn't gaslight those people who have huge problems of addiction. Bonus article 21. The Wild West of Online Testosterone Prescribing. 6 out of 7 prescriptions that are given on these online for testosterone actually are given to people who have perfectly normal testosterone. And even if you have low testosterone, it's not necessarily certain that testosterone is actually a good thing to do. 22. How do doctors' personal political affiliations affect how they care for patients? So this is actually, you know, doctors are people and they have their own views. It definitely affects along things like abortion or sexual behavior, gun use, that type of thing. Bonus article 23, climate change is hitting close to home for nearly 2 out of 3 Americans, poll find. This is a great poll for about Americans' views on climate change. And people are seeing that it's hitting home. But even with 2 out of 3 Americans saying it's hitting close to home, you have almost half of Republicans who don't think that climate change is ever going to have any significant effect, which is quite stunning denial. Bonus article 24, the NIH ICES a research project on science communication. Is it self-censorship? Short answer is probably. And this is probably the NIH being bullied by those in Congress who are responsible for a lot of science miscommunication and misinformation and don't want it to actually be even studied. Bonus article 25, how the ADA paved the way for workplace protections for women and LGBTQ plus people. This is a good historical piece The ADA was passed in 1990, and I remember when it was passed, them saying that it would take years and years and years of case law to work this out. Well, decades later, it has been a big foundational piece of legislation that has helped expand equity in America. Bonus Article 26, Mississippi remains an outlier in jailing people with serious mental illness without charges. So this is one of the worst examples. Our so-called justice system does not deal with mental illness as well. And the fact you have to lock up people with simply having a health condition without any legal charges is tragic. 27, changes in heat-related illnesses. If you're interested in looking at heat-related illness, changes due to climate change expanding, a great epidemiological overview. 28, in a summer marked by extreme heat, some suggest it's time for a national cooling standard. There are some standards for heating, you know, like schools and prisons and such have to have heat, but there isn't a cooling standard, something that needs to be done. 29, mom of two dies from drinking too much water after feeling dehydrated on family trip. Yes, it is possible to have too much of a good thing. Rare, but you actually can drink too much water. Bonus Article 30, field sobriety tests cannot reliably identify drivers under the influence of cannabis. So like in California, when marijuana use was fully legalized, they've seen a 70% rise in not drunk driving, but under the influence driving. But there actually isn't really a good way to sort out cannabis intoxication versus others. Bonus Article 31, Oppenheimer is a must-watch for everyone who works in AI and healthcare. That shows the large parallels of moral and ethical social issues that parallel AI and healthcare. 32, it's a busy, noisy, bright world for millions. Going out is hard due to sensory processing disorder that makes sight, sound, and smells feeling overwhelmed. If you're one of those folks, this might be the article for you. 33, as black lung disease declines, silicosis in miners is taking its place. 34, after decades of delays and broken promises, coal miners hail rule to slow rise of black lung driven by silicosis. So in the coal mining, now that they're mining places with even less and less coal, they're having to bull through a lot of just regular granite, which is silicone, and that just basically gets in the lungs rather than the coal dust and basically drives the same problems. And coal miners were excluded from the same levels that were required in other workplaces. Real problem. 35, fatigue can shatter a person. Everyday tiredness is nothing like the depleting symptom that people with long COVID and chronic fatigue syndrome experience. 36, switching from the average American omnivore diet to a fully plant-based diet saves 1.15 acres of land. So if you're living in the city and go on a vegan diet, you could actually be saving more than an acre of land. 37, the life-changing, solar-charged power of sustainable, regenerative travel that reconnects us with nature. So, you know, biking for trips and that type of thing, another kind of lifestyle way. We need a big change on our world, and that's one of them. 38, the COVID virus is learning new tricks, and we humans keep falling behind. This is a great example. There's two, one's a set of mutations, one's a singular mutation that looks like, COVID is doing it again, where it's learning new tricks and could be potentially problems for the fall. Keep an eye on that one. 39, and last, U.S. News and World Report hospital rankings for Toledo. Spoiler alert, none of Toledo hospitals are in the top tier. You can view these and all the other stories I reported on this show by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, Passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.